do it. Doesn't matter where you are. It's like Edward Weston, the great American photographer, said, composition is the strongest way of seeing. Once you get a mnemonic pattern, which is rooted into your deep self, you can take that eye or that ear into nature and hear in that way. Because you can do this, because nature accepts this from man, the inescapable conclusion is that we are not bound by this world or any world in which we find ourselves. We are not bound by it. It may be a home which we have accepted, but in no way is it a limitation which we, by necessity, must always acquiesce to. The meaning of that is that we are free to go whenever and wherever we wish to go. At that point of being able to exercise our deep self remembrance, the field of interruption is infinite. Come in. Come and change this. There's blanks in there in the top. Help yourself. Just a few more minutes. I'm trying to fill this in for you so you can understand. The very structure of logic, which was developed in the West, has this both hidden and misunderstood at the same time. It's both hidden and misunderstood. I'm saying to you that late 20th century science is both a spiritual expression and is an ignorant illusion. It has both qualities ambidextrously at the very same time. So that it's kind of like science personified is an immoral genius. It's up to us to teach it the right moral. If we don't teach that person of science ethics, it has the power to destroy as well as the power to cure. It's like that. It's already built into the mental evolution. It's in the structure of the mind. And it's always been there. It's always been the case. And every time this has become a crisis point in human history, there have been people in those generations who have tended to this and done this right. Have educated that ambidextrous capacity which is manifested in the world, have taught it that its deep self is here in this person who understands. One makes the cosmos responsive to the awakened person. The Buddha tells the cosmos in such a way that every level of being in the entire cosmos comes to hear what the Buddha has to say. It's like that kind of an archetype. That when man is fully awakened and there, every level of existence anywhere in the universe is attentive to hear that. Because these are new purposes. These are new visions to do. If not carefully handled, the illusion parallel to that becomes megalomania in an ego. And you could see how in our age this really is getting to a very dicey situation. So we should also seek to recover an order of events or impressions which will lead us to the object of our search, for the movements of recollection follow the same order as the original events, as the making of the image base. So it's important to generate an image base That's correct. What is a correct image base? Not that it jives with some doctrine, not that it jives with some diagrammatic mental structure, but that it comes out of the veracity of what we actually do. That image base comes out of what we actually do. Not what we think we're doing, or we hope we're doing, or we expect, well, we'll do it next week when we get there, but what actually we are doing, and that ritual comportment of what we do is affine to the nature in which we find ourselves. As long as we're on this planet, and we have to observe this gravity, we have to observe this atmosphere, we have to observe this water table ecology, all of this is necessary. And if we don't, if what we do is not in sync with that nature, we begin to pull away. And our whole image base begins to skew. And the associative forming of that are illusions which the conscious mind doesn't even realize that anciently and long ago in this process, it's already screwed up. Very important. And she writes, and the things that are easiest to remember are those which have an order, like mathematical propositions. But we need a starting point from which to initiate the effort of recollection. You have to have a starting point. In Buddhism, it's called the bodhicitta. Without that, nothing starts. One's like the gerbil spinning one's wheels. She quotes here, then, from Aristotle's book on the memory and reminiscences. In translation, it reads, it often happens that a man cannot recall at the moment, but can search for what he wants and find it. This occurs when a man indicates many impulses until at last he initiates that which the object of his search will follow. A way of doing this was like Benjamin Franklin's way of, when coming to an intellectual decision, to list down all of the pros and all of the cons, make two lists of all of them, and then through conscious inspection, the pros and the cons tend to cancel each other out. That there are pros that are related to certain cons, certain pros and certain cons. And that as you pair them up, as you bring the opposites into reconciliation in this way, thought teaches itself by this process of inquiry and introspection, what's the right way to go? Because one of those lists, pros and cons, will have something in which there's nothing matched up. There'll be something left over that isn't canceled out. That's yet to do. That's yet to manifest. So that's the way to go. You go that way. And this way, Franklin, and it's in his autobiography, he shows you the technique in his autobiography. Franklin brings back in what Aristotle is talking about here in On Memory and Reminiscence, which is the ancient art of self-delving and person-making. And that's what Franklin was interested in. Person-making and delving to the self. So that it's a process of making conscious to yourself what the issues are, pro and con in this sense, but also in a deeper associative way, you have to take in what doesn't occur and some things that are obverses and not reverses and so forth. For remembering really depends, writes Aristotle, for remembering really depends upon the potential existence of the stimulating cause. But he must seize hold of the starting point. For this reason, some use places, and the Greek word for this is topan, T-O-P-A-N. He uses the the objective here instead of topoi topon. For this reason, some use places for the purpose of recollecting. What are the places for? It's just like Franklin's list, remembering all of the pros and cons in terms of being arranged in a place. You have this kind of sense then that the pros and cons are not just pairing up, but that all of them are related in such a sense that there's a structure here. It's not just a structure of a building, but in this case, in the Franklin example, it's the structure of the idea. So that one becomes conscious, maybe for the first time, maybe you never had the consciousness, that you're now thinking within an idea, that all these pros and cons are not just happenstance, but they are facets of a single idea. So that the consciousness understands that what is to be grasped here is not just the pros and cons, but the shape of the whole idea that one is working. What is the idea that I need to work through here? And by making the idea consciousness, Plato, in one of his dialogues, says this is the aha in philosophy. Whoa, that's what I'm working with. This idea. And by making that clear to yourself, and the definition of the idea is not going to some dictionary, that's stupid, but it's making clear inside of your mind the defining pros and cons of the structure of that idea. Where does that idea occur? In the symbolic self. That's where that idea is. That's making the unconscious conscious, to use some Jungian terms. But you must understand here that to think that the unconscious is some unknown that you could never make it conscious if it really were that. Socrates says of himself, "I'm a midwife of ideas. I help you to learn how to give birth to your ideas, bring them out of your symbolic vision, out of your deep self, and bring them into your mind, into your consciousness, so you can see that this is what you're thinking about. Now it's clear what you're thinking about. You're not thinking about the pros and cons of some issue that you don't really understand. Now you understand what it is. And there are ways of even having ideas of ideas. One could use this technique very, very powerfully. So he writes, Aristotle, in translation, "The reason for this is that men pass rapidly from one step to the next." The reason why we don't know this is we pass very rapidly through this whole sequence. We do it automatically, almost like rote. We don't realize that we've gone through a phase process. So at least once in our life, at least once in our education, we have to be able to see, like in slow motion, what are these steps? And once we have the idea, once we have the overall pattern, the conceptual shape of it, it's much easier for us then in analysis to understand exactly what are the steps that we go through. And that analysis can be to any extent of exactness you want. There's no limit to the exactness. I don't know if you've ever seen a good higher mathematical library, but rooms and rooms and rooms full of analytical capabilities. Unbelievable potential. She writes, "What is certain here is that Aristotle, in bringing in the places of quote, artificial memory, to illustrate his remarks on association and order in the process of recollection. But apart from that, the meaning of the passage is very difficult to follow, as editors and annotators admit." It's difficult to follow because they don't put the spiritual emphasis, which is there in it. She writes, "It is immediately followed by a passage in which Aristotle is speaking of recollecting through starting at any one point in a series." And I'll give you this, and then we're through for today. This is Aristotle's beautiful presentation, generally misunderstood, of how once one has the central idea, any element of that idea can be used as a starting point for further thought. And one can go back and forth in any direction with understanding the analysis of the idea from any point. But the way in which he wrote it out, by using the example of the alphabet, he used the Greek alphabet, and the translation uses the English alphabet. The error in the medieval mind, still habitually schooled to a kind of a rote imitation, a dead imitation, took it to be that logical order follows a linear path, exclusively linear path. And that's a complete idiotic misunderstanding, even of what Aristotle wrote, much less of the way in which logic can operate truth in truth. Here's the quotation, and this is from Aristotle's On Memory and Remembrance, and it's a statement about logical order. It's had enormous influence in the world. He wrote, "Generally speaking, the middle point seems to be a good point to start from. For one will recollect when one comes to this point, if not before, or else one will not recollect from any other. For instance, suppose one were thinking of a series, which may be represented by the letters A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H. If one does not recall what is wanted at E, yet one does at H, from that point it is possible to travel in either direction, that is, either towards D or towards F. Supposing one is seeking for either G or F, one will recollect on arriving at C if one wants G or F. If not, then on arrival at A. Success is always achieved in this way. Sometimes it is possible to recall what we seek, and sometimes not. The reason being that it is possible to travel from the same starting point in more than one direction. For instance, from C, we may go direct to F, or only to D." She writes, Dame Frances writes, "Since the starting point in a train of recollection," a train of recollection, it's like a line of argument, a train of recollection, "since the starting point in a train of recollection has earlier been likened to a mnemonic locus place, we may recall in connection with this pretty confusing passage that one of the advantages of the artificial memory was that its possessor could start at any point in his places and run through them in any direction." What happened in Western history, in Western thought, is that this passage from Aristotle became the model on which logical thought was constructed. So that there was a line of argument. And the linear propensity, exclusively, of the modern Western mind is literally an accident of misinterpretation coming from this very point. But notice here, one more little arcane realization, one more grand idea from a deep symbolic self that's aware of this. The truth is still hidden within the process. The truth of it, the truth is still hidden within the process, so that within the logic, even misunderstood, conceiving of logic as a linearity, is still the truth that it's not so much that one can move back and forth on a train of thought and keep to the rails of accuracy, but the hidden truth is that one can move omnidirectional, and that the metaphor of the lines is only a metaphor, and the true process is unveiling the palace of wisdom, or the largest structure that one can imagine, not just a palace of wisdom, but the city of God, the true city of the true God. That's implicit in there. And in fact, maybe next week I can dig out and show for you. Several people have done a very high, penetrating, spiritual analysis of the greatest writer on logic of the 20th century, Ludwig Wittgenstein. And taking Wittgenstein's writings as a whole, his body of work as a whole, they've been able to show that his constant hidden metaphors, his chosen symbolic examples, always have references to aspects of a city. And that the hidden symbol in Wittgenstein's logical writings is an image of an eternal city, which is like a mnemonic place where accuracy is stored. It's a wonderful, wonderful observation. Even Wittgenstein himself was unaware of this, except for the fact that in personal life, his personal love was not to be a logician or a philosopher or writing on philosophy, but he wanted to be an architect. And in fact, he built and designed some houses. And I think somewhere I have an article on Wittgenstein's architecture. But all of his hidden metaphors in his work taken as a whole refer not to logic as a line of argument like keeping the alphabet straight, but to unfold the entire structure of a city within man's remembrance and understanding is a very, very powerful realization. Well, I will try and fix these for you, try and get this chapter Xerox for you, get some extra paper. If you get a chance, I didn't get a chance to go today, but I'm going to move from The Art of Memory to this book, Artistic Form and Yoga in the Sacred Images of India by Heinrich Zimmer. And if you have some money, get yourself a copy of Zimmer's book along with Yeats's book. And I'll go through the rest of Chapter 2 next week with sliding over and making an emphasis on Zimmer's section here on outward sight and inward vision, and moving over to yoga and the linear sacred image, the yantra and the mandala. So I'm going to try and bring these two works together for you next week. We're talking about a divine gift, and the divine gift, when we are able to accept it, seals our integrity of accuracy. It's just like that. The religious way of talking about it is that when man accepts God's gift of life, his life is sealed against any death. And it's a way of talking about having the mind and the person and the deep self align in accuracy to be able to understand what is really true. And not to get worried because tangents seem to be leading off into areas where there's no return. The truth is that all the tangents curl back and come back home again, because there is, in reality, only one reality. Though it has many mansions, there's only one reality. my late friend Theodore Sturgeon used to say, out of the 10 million things that can happen, only one really will. And you can deal with that. Thank you.